We have some shocking news for you, possibly 10 killed and at least 20 more wounded. Those are the grim numbers right now out of Roseburg, Oregon.
On Thursday, yet another American exercising his Second Amendment right to protect himself and his family from criminals or a tyrannical government chose from his arsenal of 13 handguns, rifles, and a shotgun to assassinate 9 men and women. 8 of them were community college students working to better their lives. Now they are dead. Now they're dead. The murderer may have been licensed to carry some of the weapons, but for reasons soon to be explained, the press does not know. Like everyone else facing the recurring fusillade, the media are powerless. Yet obliged for the 11th time of his 7-year presidency to offer public thoughts and prayers over a mass gun atrocity, President Obama sought assistance from an unlikely source.
I would ask news organizations, because I won't put these facts forward, have news organizations tally up the number of Americans who've been killed through terrorist attacks over the last decade and the number of Americans who've been killed by gun violence, and post those side by side on your news reports.
The media complied, and the statistics are sickening. Including the attacks of 9/11, there have been just over 3,000 Americans killed by terrorists in the past 15 years, and approximately 200,000 murdered by guns, with accidents and suicide all told, 500,000. For this, we have to thank the coordinated efforts, explicit and without apology, of the National Rifle Association and the Republican Party, not only to block gun control legislation of any kind, but even to block the collection of data to document and understand gun ownership and gun violence. In this particular case, the press were able quickly to produce Obama's requested statistic. But through much of the past 40 years, journalists, as well as academics, public health officials, criminologists, and even law enforcement itself, have been systematically stymied in compiling even most basic information. On Thursday, when the latest bloodbath took place in Roseburg, Oregon, one reporter recalled his own unintentional role in the suppression of basic government data. Michael Luo of the New York Times had been looking into the incidents of people with concealed weapons permits committing crimes when he filed a routine request in Oregon. He'd been doing some reporting on the shooting of Arizona Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords in 2011.
I wanted to look at gun permit data in a couple of states to try to see how well states were vetting people who had handgun licenses. Also, I wanted to look at how often people who have gun licenses, gun permits, committed crimes. And so I went to Oregon, among other states, to request from them data on their concealed handgun license holders.
And this was because Oregon was one of the few states that offered any public access to that data.
Exactly. The vast majority of states, it's definitively stated in the law that it's not a public record. In Oregon, at the time, it was considered a public record, but the sheriffs in the state, which handled concealed handgun license applications, had been difficult in terms of turning over those records. But I thought it was still worth it. And so I went to the Oregon State Police and requested data first on just their entire database of concealed handgun license holders. Then, as sort of a backup, I asked for information on people who have been rejected in their applications for concealed handgun license holders. And basically, they just kept delaying, and you know, it became very clear to me that I wasn't going to be able to get the data. And so I went to North Carolina, another state where the data was public, and they basically sent me a DVD of the data the next day. And so I went on to use that data to do a really interesting investigative story analyzing their concealed handgun permit holder data against criminal records, and found something like 10% of the permit holders there had gone on to commit a felony or misdemeanor. And one of the most disturbing things was a lot of people who had been convicted of felonies after they had a concealed handgun permit still had their permit. They had not been revoked by the state. So that actually caused some folks down there to say, oh, this is actually a loophole that we hadn't really been catching in the system. And so they were trying to figure out a way to fix it.
Meanwhile, though, concerning your similar request in Oregon, you discovered in no uncertain terms what impact the New York Times can have instantly.
Somehow, somebody in the legislature found out that the New York Times had requested this data, and also the Portland Oregonian, the newspaper out there, had requested the data in a little bit of a back-end way, where they asked for whatever the New York Times asked for. You can do that in public record requests. So there are actually two requests that were pending for the concealed handgun license data. Legislators found out about this and immediately were alarmed. So they introduced legislation that would put these records off limits from public consumption.
Retroactively.
Yes, it functioned retroactively. And they made that clear in the debate that this would ensure that the New York Times did not get this data. Some of the gun control groups out there had kept me apprised of this, and they were calling this the New York Times Amendment.
Here's a bit of what that floor debate sounded like.
This clause is important because currently two requests have been made for gun records on CHL holders. My understanding, those two requests that are pending are for statewide records by the Oregonian newspaper as well as the New York Times.
I actually had never heard that bit live from the floor. Anyways, in the end, the measure sailed through and was signed into law. And so today in Oregon, for reporters who might be interested in knowing, for example, more about concealed handgun permit holders in the wake of the shooting, or how well the state does in terms of preventing people who shouldn't have guns from getting these permits, there would be no way for them to do systematic data analysis on that, thanks to yours truly at the New York Times.
Who were the principals who lobbied the Oregon legislature to shut this source of information down?
There is a pro-gun group, the Oregon Firearms Federation. They put out alerts. They sent out emails. I don't think they actually used the name New York Times, but they said an East Coast newspaper with deep pockets. And they called on their members to call their legislators to support this. I should mention that I understand to a degree the concern in terms of, like, they are saying that, oh, the New York Times is going to get this data and they're going to put it on the internet and our privacy will be invaded, our lives will be in danger, our homes could be potentials for robbers and things like that. But obviously that was not what I did with the data in North Carolina. What I did with the data was actually a very interesting and useful analysis that actually even pro-gun folks down there appreciated that I did. They didn't appreciate everything I did on that, but like they were alarmed that people who were felons were still able to hold on to their gun permits. So when states shut down access to this data, and more states have done this, and fewer states have this available, it makes it impossible to analyze in any comprehensive way all kinds of questions, how well they're vetting people who are carrying these kinds of permits, how often these people go on to commit crimes. There are all kinds of legitimate sort of public health type questions that are not able to be answered at this point.
Just to be clear, it's not just that the majority of state legislatures and the U.S. Congress have limited the amount of specific license data that is public information. They have made it unlawful for jurisdictions to even gather gun crime data that can be used to analyze for, you know, any number of social, scientific, or law enforcement reasons. You can't even comprehensively find out what crimes were committed involving guns, and that's, again, from the direct lobbying of the National Rifle Association and other pro-gun organizations?
Right. Now you're touching on something else that I actually wrote about, too, back in 2011 after the Gabby Giffords shooting. This issue of the NRA shutting down public funding of research on gun violence with the CDC.
That's the Centers for Disease Control, the epidemiology arm of the U.S. government.
Right. And there's this huge battle over it, and the result of it, and it continues to this day, is that the CDC cannot spend money on public health research relating to guns.
The North Carolina stories you referred to began with a very powerful anecdote about a shooting. Not to put too fine a point on it, if we had access to the other states where these records are not publicly available, there, I'm sure, would be many horror stories to share, but we cannot know.
We cannot know. I wish that we could do it in Oregon. I wish we could have done it in South Carolina after the Charleston shootings. Like, you know, you want to answer some of these questions after these types of events. And in most cases, you just can't do it.
Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Michael Luo is deputy metro editor for the New York Times. He wrote about his experience for Medium. John Hanlon is the sheriff of Douglas County, Oregon. He also withheld some vital information from the press.
Let me be very clear. I will not name the shooter. I will not give him the credit he probably sought prior to this horrific and cowardly act. Media will get the name confirmed in time, but you will never hear me mention his name.
In this case, official suppression of public information was futile. Within minutes, the media were quoting anonymous federal officials to name the dead shooter, who within a few hours was revealed to have been exactly the troubled, introverted, gun-obsessed misfit we all expected him to be. But now that we know that, Sheriff Hanlon's refusal begins to take on a certain logic. In a society that has largely ceased to discriminate notoriety from celebrity, that is quick to make icons and antiheroes and even role models out of sociopaths, what good is served by giving those sociopaths the posthumous publicity they craved? Sheriff Hanlon isn't the only one who believes the relentless repetition of killers' names and images makes the press a sort of accessory to mayhem. Indeed, the Roseburg killer himself mused over the attention heaped a month ago on the Roanoke, Virginia murderer of a local news team, writing in a blog post, quote, "A man who was known by no one is now known by everyone. His face splashed across every screen, his name across the lips of every person on the planet, all in the course of one day. Seems the more people you kill, the more you're in the limelight." In January, I spoke to Tom Teeves, whose son Alex was murdered in the 2012 Aurora, Colorado movie theater shooting. Teeves spoke about his campaign he calls No Notoriety.
When we talk to different journalists and they talk about, well, we have to research their background to find out what motivated them, I much applaud that. You do need to research their background. What you don't need to do is use their names and their likenesses. Definitely, if they're at large, use their names and their likenesses to bring them to justice. But once they're apprehended, that's really no longer part of the story, other than to create a call to action for another like-minded killer to take his plans and his thoughts and make them deeds.
So the press becomes an accessory after the fact to giving a deranged gunman exactly what he's looking for to begin with, and then an accessory before the fact by motivating killers to do the same thing.
That's exactly right. And if you look through the different data, you'll find that. Now, you have to be careful because this is all basically case study data, because obviously we don't want to conduct an experiment on something like this.
But the case studies, and there have been many of them, give profilers at the FBI a pretty solid idea, without a double-blind experiment, as you say, of the common threads motivating this kind of outrage. What does the FBI have to say on this?
The FBI doesn't want you to name them. They don't want you to talk to them. They don't want their pictures. Some of the psychiatrists say that if you have to put a picture of them on, if you just can't stop yourself, the reasonable thing to do is show a picture of them either in a very unflattering pose or preferably on the autopsy table. Because remember, what you're dealing with is suicidal people in most cases. Unfortunately, not in my case, but this isn't about me. This is about stopping the future. My ship has sailed. My son is dead. No one can bring him back. This is about saving your children and your grandchildren and possibly yourself.
No Notoriety has a list of protocols that it proposes for media outlets to follow in the wake of one of these mass shootings. What's on the list?
It says limit the name and likeness of the individual from reporting except when necessary for initial identification. Refuse to broadcast, publish photos, and or self-serving statements made by the individual. Now, that's a key piece. Many of these have manifestos. I struggle to think that many of the media that published the manifestos actually spent the time to read the manifestos to come up with the motivation. You're really doing it because you're reporting on a story. You're not doing the in-depth analysis of what motivates them. Then recognize that name and likeness is irrelevant to media coverage, except when the alleged assailant is still at large, and in doing so would aid in the capture. Then realize that the prospect of infamy could serve as a motivating factor and will inspire copycat crimes. And agree to promote data and analysis from experts in mental health, public safety, and other relevant professions to support further steps to help eliminate the motivation behind mass murder. What we're asking you to do is be responsible. And we're not asking you to do something you don't already do. You don't name rape victims. You keep children's names out of the news. This is a very, very small area that you would have to become responsible, and you would save lives.
The public is keenly interested, in varying degrees of nobility, ranging from morbid curiosity and bloodlust to assurance the justice system is functioning as it's designed to. This stuff is public information by law and by design. Why should that change when there is an Aurora or a Sandy Hook or a Fort Hood?
If it had changed in Aurora, perhaps there wouldn't be a Sandy Hook or what happened in the Washington Navy Yard. There's no need to name the individual. There's no need to show their picture. It doesn't change your story. My son would be just as dead from someone named John Doe. The name is irrelevant. And 95% of the people agree with us at this point. So I would argue that the public really doesn't want to see or hear them.
You have had some success. There have been news organizations which have rethought the journalistic routine. Who are they?
Well, we've had some success with the local people in Denver. We've had success with Anderson Cooper, with CNN and Reliable Sources. But it has to become something that you guys realize is responsible. Right now, I can tell in your voice that you don't agree with me. And you're trained to do exactly what I'm asking you not to do.
Well, as a matter of fact, our job is pretty much defined by five questions. Who, what, when, where, why? And right at the top of the list is who.
So I would answer, if the who starts to create the why, then you have an issue. I am saying that, but I'm not the authority. The authorities, the psychologists, and again, the FBI are saying it. The reality is, and we both know that in today's digitally driven world, you can get the name of someone who killed someone in 1854 by going through the internet. If they really want to know their name, they have complete access to it.
Based on conversations you've had with people like me, do you have a sense that you can chip away at this, or this is an insurmountable obstacle, this instinct to name names?
I don't think anything's insurmountable. I think if rational people have rational conversations and make rational decisions for the greater good, that we'll get where we need to go. All I ask is that you think about it.
Tom, thank you.
You're welcome.
Tom Teeves is the co-founder of NoNotoriety.com. His son, Alex, was murdered in the July 2012 movie theater shootings in Aurora, Colorado. This has been a special podcast edition of On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
WNYC Studios is supported by the Brennan Center for Justice, presenting The Failed Experiment of Mass Incarceration. This virtual event on Wednesday, April 17th at 3 p.m. will feature criminal justice advocates and contributors to the new book, Excessive Punishment: How the Justice System Creates Mass Incarceration. They will discuss why the American approach to criminal justice is so punitive and how reforms would prioritize human dignity and restoration over retribution. Find more information and register for this event at brennancenter.org/events.